happy birthday today to Nicholas Kuthman of Urbandale, to Chadwick Harrison of Spencer, and to Sylvia Butterfield in Des Moines. Happy birthday to you one and all. We have some celebrities that will join you in your birthday today. Haley Mills turned 78. Actor James Wood turned 77, and comic ventriloquist Jeff Dunham turned 62. Also, if you keep up with the Kardashians, you may want to know that Kourtney turns 45 today. A happy birthday to all of you. You're listening to IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service. If you are hearing us on your television on Iowa PBS and you are not a registered IRIS user, please give us a call at 515-243-6833 so we can get you on our list. We need to know who's listening in order to keep our services free. And now here's Lisa with our first obituary.
James Mulford of Des Moines. James Jim Edward Mulford, age 90, passed away on the 13th of April. He was born on May 6, 1933 in Creston, the son of the late Joseph Raymond Mulford and Carrie Elizabeth Kessler. He was raised on a farm outside of Prescott. He graduated from Prescott High School in 1952. Jim then enlisted in the United States Navy at the age of 18 and worked as second-class petty officer, machinist mate. He fought in the Korean War. After serving our country, he married the love of his life, Shirley Joan Brown, in Lenox on August 8, 1954, and together they had three wonderful daughters. He went on to graduate from the University of Chicago with a degree in engineering, and he came to Des Moines and immediately started working at Bell Brothers Heating and Air Conditioning. During his career at Bell Brothers, he started the first fire department in Clive and was asked to become the first fire chief. After serving 5 years at the fire station, Jim went on to serve as a police officer of Clive for several years. For 25 years, he served his community by working on the Civil Service Commission of Clive. A true lover of working, he continued to stay busy after retirement by working at Stu Hansen Dodge City and teaching classes at the Des Moines Area Community College. Jim was a hard worker, lover of people, and he never knew a stranger. He was always ready to lend a helping hand, and there was nothing he couldn't fix. He was a jack of all trades and always willing to offer services to anyone in need. He cherished his visits with many friends and family the most. James is preceded in death by his wife, Shirley Mulford, and his eldest daughter, Linda Lee Rogers, with spouse Randy. He is survived by his two daughters, Karen Mulford Said, with spouse John Said, who is deceased, and Michelle Mulford Cole, spouse Chuck. His 12 grandchildren, 7 great-grandchildren, and 2 great-great-grandchildren, as well as many extended family members and loved ones. Funeral services will be held at 11 a.m. Friday, April 19th, at Lutheran Church of Hope on Jordan Creek Parkway in West Des Moines. Interment will be at the Iowa Veterans Cemetery at a later date. Elsa Adele McDowell of West Des Moines. Adele was born to Elsa and John Schoenemann at their farm near Kelsey. She joined Aureen Eldon and Ruth Schoenemann, and sister Joan followed. As a child, she developed a love of being outdoors, playing the piano, reading, and singing. Holidays with her parents, siblings, and many nieces and nephews were a beloved part of life. In 1962, the McDowell family moved to Decorah. Adele graduated from Luther College, cum laude, in 1967. She resumed teaching at Eastside Elementary School and then at middle schools in Eagle Grove, Tacoma, and Des Moines. She earned her Master's of Arts in 1974. At the First United Methodist Church, she sang in the choir, participated in community outreach programs, and served on missions to Kenya and New Orleans. She was an avid conversationalist and enriched the lives of her 5 children, their families and friends, John and Christine Ryan McDowell of Rapid City, South Dakota, Frank and Marilyn Burge McDowell of Spirit Lake, Iowa, Janice McDowell, who is deceased, Jane McCarver of the Gulf Shores in Alabama, and Bessie McDowell and John Gussenhoven of Salem, Oregon. Her husband, Frank, died in 1993. She is survived by her brother-in-law, Wendell Abkes, of Parkersburg and 7 grandchildren and 7 great-grandchildren. In lieu of flowers, live your life to the fullest. Any contribution may be directed to Des Moines Symphony or the Iowa Natural Heritage Foundation or an organization of your choice.
Linda Louise Schleichman Dorr went home to the Lord on Sunday, April 14 of this year, at home with her family by her side. Funeral services will be at 11:30 a.m. Friday, April 19, 2024, at St. Pius X Catholic Church. Visitation will be from 5 to 7 p.m. Thursday, April 18, at Westover Funeral Home. Linda was born January 2, 1953, in Sac City to Vernon and Helen Schroer Schleichman. Linda and her 4 siblings moved throughout the state of Iowa, as well as living in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, and Rockford, Illinois, as her father was a station agent on the Milwaukee Railroad. All her childhood memories included moving a lot. Linda made new friends so easily everywhere she went. She attended school at St. Sebastian, St. Pius, Franklin Junior High, and graduated from Hoover High School in 1971. Linda was preceded in death by her parents, Vernon and Helen Schroer Schleichman. Surviving her are 3 children, Kelly and partner Lynn Martin of Des Moines, Kristen and partner Michael Klein of Polk City, Elizabeth Dorr and her partner Gage Edwards of West Des Moines. Grandchildren include Dylan Kelly, Gavin Kelly, James Klein, Benjamin Klein, Grace Klein, Isabel Klein, Elijah Edwards, and Grayson Edwards. Linda was a loving, nurturing, emphatic artist of a mother who could always be found at the book fair, school fundraiser, or driving kids to or from activities. Her heart was always with her children. As she and her daughters grew older, Linda poured the same love and devotion into her grandchildren. Linda had an unwavering faith in God and carried her through life and a love of all living creatures, especially the ones she routinely fed in her backyard. In lieu of flowers, please make memorials to A. Hines 57 Pet Rescue and Transport. Mom, your family will greatly miss you and your warm smile. We know that we will be reunited someday, but until that day comes, love you. Mean it. Ciao. Todd Shoemaker. Todd Michael Shoemaker passed away on April 14. He was born October 21, 1989, in Ankeny, Iowa, and graduated from Ankeny High School in 2008. Todd is survived by his mother, Chris Shoemaker of Ankeny, sister Molly, partner Michael DaCosta of Seams, Alabama, brother Shane and partner Ashton, Georgia Shoemaker of Des Moines. Visitation will be held from 4 to 6 p.m. on Friday, April 19, 2024, at Our Lady's Immaculate Heart Catholic Church on East 1st. Carhartt and Hy-Vees are welcome. A Mass of Christian burial will be held at 10 a.m. on Saturday, April 20th, also at the church, with burial at Ankeny Memorial Gardens. Mass will be live-streamed at www.olih.org. A full obituary can be found at the Ankeny Memorial website.
And now we'll head back to our last remaining articles in the front page section of the Des Moines Register. Man to serve 25 years for sexual abuse of 12-year-old. Victim lived in Minnesota, U.S. Attorney's Office says. This is written by Jose Mendiola. A Des Moines man was sentenced to 25 years in federal prison Tuesday for sexually exploiting a 12-year-old from Minnesota. Priya Ray, 24, drove from Des Moines to Minnesota to pick up a 12-year-old from middle school and sexually abuse them at a local motel in November of 2022, according to a news release from the U.S. Attorney's Office for the Southern District of Iowa. Ray met the child online in the fall of 2022 and knew their age, according to court documents and information presented at the sentencing. Ray again drove to Minnesota and brought the child to Des Moines and sexually assaulted them in a basement bedroom, according to the news release. Ray also created an image of child sexual abuse material depicting the child and repeatedly asked the child to text him sexually explicit pictures, the news release said. During their investigation, police found a loaded pistol in Ray's bedroom, which was illegal for him to possess as a convicted felon. Ray will be required to serve 5 years of supervised release after he completes his prison term. There is no parole in the federal system. The case was investigated by the Des Moines Police Department and Minnesota's Austin Police Department and was brought as a part of Project Safe Childhood, a nationwide initiative to combat child sexual exploitation and abuse.
And the final story in the front page section has a headline, Senate Rejects Mayorkas Impeachment Articles. This is Dateline Washington. The Senate rejected both articles of impeachment against Homeland Security Secretary Alejandro Mayorkas on Wednesday, dismissing the charges against the top Biden administration official and bypassing a trial despite protests from Republican lawmakers. The Senate first dismissed the article, accusing Mayorkas of what it called willful and systematic refusal to comply with the law. They dismissed it on a 51-48 vote. Alaska Senator Lisa Murkowski voted present, splitting from her fellow Republicans. Then senators killed the second charge that Mayorkas oversaw what was called a breach of public trust in a 51-49 vote. Republicans and Democrats agreed on one thing. It was a historic moment. The Republican-led House voted to impeach Mayorkas in February by a count of 214-213, making him the second cabinet secretary in American history to be impeached. The first was nearly 150 years ago. No Democrats supported the effort, and a few Republicans also voted against it. It was always extremely unlikely that Mayorkas would be convicted. It would have required support from two-thirds of the body, and all Democrats and several Republicans argued the charges were frivolous. A group of ultra-conservative senators tried to drag out the proceedings to make it as painful as possible for Democrats by setting up multiple procedural hurdles, such as calling to adjourn for several weeks. The efforts failed, with Republicans and Democrats alike visibly frustrated. Democrats panned the Republican House efforts as a misuse of impeachment powers that could undermine American systems of checks and balances. Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer, a Democrat of New York, called the Mayorkas proceedings the least legitimate, least substantive, and most politicized impeachment trial in the history of the United States, saying the charges brought against Secretary Mayorkas failed to meet the high standard of high crimes and misdemeanors. To validate this gross abuse by the House would be a grave mistake and could set a dangerous precedent for the future, Schumer said. The Constitution sets high crimes and misdemeanors as the bar for impeaching an official. Senate Republicans argued that Democrats were flouting precedent and making a major mistake by pushing to dismiss the trial before it even began. The House had passed articles of impeachment 21 times before Mayorkas, and the Senate had held a trial in all cases except one in which the official resigned first. Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell, a Republican of Kentucky, argued Wednesday that it was the Senate's duty to at least consider the House's charges. Quoting from, I think this is McConnell speaking here. But instead, he says, the more pressing question is whether our Democratic colleagues intend to let the Senate work at its will, McConnell said. Failing to hold a trial would, in his words, mean running both from our fundamental responsibility and from the glaring truth of the record-breaking crisis at our southern border. Immigration has become a major issue in the presidential election this fall and has been in the congressional crosshairs for months.
And now we'll look at more of our 50 states with our time remaining here. I'm going to start with Iowa and zip around the states that surround us, and then we'll just go to the top of the alphabet after that. So for Iowa, in West Des Moines, independent presidential candidate Robert F. Kennedy Jr. says he has met the requirements to appear on Iowa's general election ballot in November as he works to gain access in all 50 states. In Illinois, Springfield, experts have identified the skeletal remains found at a house as those of Michelle Renee Shelley Bianco, who disappeared more than 16 years ago. Sangamon County Coroner Jim Allman confirmed the identity following Tuesday's postmortem examination, which included a forensic pathologist and anthropologist. From, let's see what would be next, Wisconsin. Madison, Wisconsin, a statute honoring Vel Phillips, the state's first black statewide elected official, will be unveiled in June after a four-year effort by elected officials, community leaders, and the civil rights leader's family. It will be the first commemoration of a black leader on the state capitol grounds. In Minnesota, Minneapolis, Uber and Lyft pumped the brakes on their exit from the Twin Cities for now. The Minneapolis City Council unanimously voted to push their pay hike back to July 1st, giving the legislature 2 months to find a statewide solution to keep the rideshare companies in operation. South Dakota, Sioux Falls. Allure Health's multi-specialty clinic is no longer serving patients, and the building is now for sale. Nebraska. In Lincoln, a Nebraska man operated a large-scale crypto-jacking scheme for defrauded cloud computing service providers out of more than $3.5 million worth of services, the U.S. Attorney's Office said. In Kansas, Topeka, research changing the way lead in water is found helped Ethan Connors elevate his scientific career and determine what his future will look like. Washburn University Chemistry Senior, Connors received the James Manner Award at Pittsburgh Conference of Analytical Chemistry and Applied Spectroscopy, an international conference for analytical chemistry. And in Missouri, St. Louis, police say a Missouri mother, too drunk to drive, had her 8-year-old son get behind the wheel and take her and his 3-year-old sibling home, according to court documents. And starting at the top of the alphabet, we'll have Alabama, Birmingham. Authorities in Alabama arrested a man and charged him with capital murder in the kidnapping and death of Nikita Chantrice Davidson, who was found dead in her car on Friday. In Anchorage, Alaska, state officials announced the usual May 1 deadline for most Alaskans to remove snow tires has been delayed to May 15th as Anchorage nears a record snowfall total, Alaska Public Media reports. In Phoenix, Arizona, U.S. Senate candidate Carrie Lake's campaign added to its debt total in the first 3 months of the year and appeared to raise less money than her team said on Sunday, according to records filed Monday. And in Arkansas, Fort Smith. A Fort Smith native has been crowned Miss America, and she is coming home. A homecoming parade and meet-and-greet event is in store for Madison Marsh, the 2024 Miss America, on May 10th.
And heading to the West Coast in Los Angeles, California, the University of Southern California said its valedictorian will not deliver a graduation speech this year because of security risk tied to controversy over the Israeli-Hamas war. From Colorado Springs, Colorado, the owners of a Colorado Springs funeral home have been indicted on federal charges, including fraud related to COVID-19 relief funds. Authorities say they failed to cremate or bury at least 190 bodies that they were paid to handle, dating back to at least 2019, according to court documents. From Killingsworth, Connecticut, two vultures rescued in Connecticut were believed to be dying. Turns out they were just drunk. Wildlife rehabilitation at a place called Hope, in a post on social media, said that the two vultures, nicknamed the Dynamic Duo, that's one for the books. And from Willington, Delaware, what's the cost of climate change? About $23 million for just one project in Delaware. That's the estimate for a new bridge and road in a flood-prone area on Route 9 east of Townsend. But the state has received a big chunk of those funds from the federal government. And let's do one more before we go to a story from USA Today. District of Columbia. In Washington, D.C., a Howard University student was killed near campus when a speeding car, reportedly being driven by a faculty member, struck him.
All right, and in international, international news, Netanyahu Israel will defend itself. The West continues to call for restraint. This is written by James McKenzie and Nadal al-Mughrabi for the Reuters. Dateline, Jerusalem, Cairo. Israel will make its own decisions about how to defend itself, Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said on Wednesday as Western countries pleaded for restraint in responding to a volley of attacks from Iran. European Union leaders decided on Wednesday to step up sanctions against Iran after Tehran's missile and drone attack on Israel left world powers scrambling to prevent a wider conflict in the Middle East. We feel it's very important to do everything to isolate Iran, said Charles Michel, chairman of the EU summit in Brussels, adding the new sanctions against the Islamic Republic would target companies involved in the production of drones and missiles. The United States and the G7 group of industrialized nations were each considering tighter sanctions on Iran, seeing as aimed at mollifying Israel and persuading it to rein in its retaliation for the first ever direct Iranian strikes after decades of confrontation by proxy. Washington says it's planning to impose new sanctions targeting Iran's missile and drone programs in coming days. Iran attacked in retaliation for a suspected Israeli airstrike on its embassy compound in Damascus, Syria, on April 1st. Israel and its allies mostly shot down all missiles and drones. There were no deaths, but Israel says it must retaliate to preserve the credibility of its deterrence. Iran says it views the matter as closed, but will retaliate again if Israel does. Israel's Air Force said late on Wednesday its fighter jets had struck the terrorist infrastructure of Iranian-backed Hezbollah in eastern Lebanon. Earlier, Netanyahu met with the German and British foreign ministers, who both traveled to Israel as part of a coordinated push to keep confrontation between Israel and Iran from escalating into a regional conflict fueled by the Gaza war. Netanyahu's office said he thanked Annalena Baerbock and David Cameron for their support while telling them, I want to make it clear, we will make our own decisions and the state of Israel will do everything necessary to defend itself. Earlier, Cameron said it was now apparent that Israel planned to retaliate for the Iranian missile and drone strikes. Baerbock said escalation would serve no one. Not Israel's security, not the many dozens of hostages still in the hands of Hamas, not the suffering population of Gaza, not the many people in Iran who are themselves suffering under that regime. More than 6 months into the Gaza war between Israel and the Iranian-backed Palestinian militant group Hamas that has been seen flare-ups across the Middle East, diplomats are searching for a way to avert direct battle between Israel and Iran. Jordan said, or added to the calls for the restraint, warning of a war that could be devastating for the region. The risks are enormous. That could drag the whole region into war, which would be devastating to us in the region, and we'll have a very, very serious implications for the rest of the world, including the U.S., Foreign Minister Ayman Safadi said. Since Hamas fighters triggered the war in Gaza by attacking southern Israel, killing 1,200 people and capturing 253 hostages, according to Israeli tallies, clashes have erupted between Israel and Iranian-aligned groups based in Lebanon, Syria, Yemen, and Iraq. Inside Gaza, Israel has launched a massive air and ground assault with nearly 34,000 people confirmed killed, according to Palestinian medics, and thousands of others feared dead still lost among the ruins. This month, Israel abruptly pulled most of its troops out of southern Gaza, the site of most of the heaviest fighting since the start of the year. Fighting in recent days has been focused in central Gaza, in the Nusayrat refugee camp north of one of the few areas that Israeli troops have yet to storm. Israeli forces retreated from the camp late on Wednesday, residents and some Israeli media said. At a hospital morgue in Deir al-Balah, members of the al-Nuri family bellowed in sorrow and anger over bodies in body bags, several the size of small children. In a video obtained by the media, authorities said 11 people had been killed in an Israeli strike on the family home on Tuesday. Oh, people of the world, what is happening is wrong. Have mercy on us. Stop the war. Children are dying in the streets, a man cried inside the crowded hospital. In the southern city of Rafah, the Israeli airstrike on a house killed several Palestinians, including a woman and three children, medics said. Elsewhere, Hamas media reported Israeli forces had withdrawn from Beit Hanun in northern Gaza after a 36-hour raid there on Israel's northern border with Lebanon, where cross-border battles between Israeli forces and the Iran-aligned Hezbollah movement pose an escalated risk. Hezbollah said it had launched missiles and drones at a military facility in northern Israel in retaliation for the Israeli strikes that killed Hezbollah members. Israel said 14 of its soldiers were hurt in the incident, six of them seriously. Israel says it will discuss a pause to free hostages, but will not stop fighting until Hamas is wiped out. Hamas says it will not release hostages without a truce leading to an end to the war. Qatar, which has served as mediator, said negotiations were at a delicate phase. It later said it was re-evaluating its role as mediator, citing concerns that its efforts are being undermined by those pursuing narrow political interests. With the prospect of famine looming, the United States and Israel say access for aid has improved this month, but aid agencies say supplies of food and medicine are still too paltry to stave off disaster. Across Gaza, a man-made famine is tightening its grip. Philippe Lazzarini, head of the United Nations Palestinian Refugee Agency, the UNRWA, told the 15-member UN Council Security Council, "In the north, infants and young children have begun to die of malnutrition and dehydration. Across the border, food and clean water wait."
And USA Today's Nation and World section has a number of short pieces from around the country. Let's see how many of them we can get in here before the end of our shift. The first, Biden says his uncle was shot down over the area with cannibals in World War II. This is Dateline Pittsburgh. President Joe Biden on Wednesday raised the possibility that an uncle who served in the Pacific campaign during World War II might have fallen victim to cannibals after his plane was shot down over New Guinea. Biden made the comment after visiting a missing-in-action war memorial in his childhood home of Scranton, Pennsylvania, and putting his hand on the engraved name of Ambrose Finnegan, whose plane was shot down and whose body was never recovered. He flew single-engine planes, reconnaissance flights over New Guinea. He had volunteered because someone couldn't make it. He got shot down in an area where there were a lot of cannibals in New Guinea at the time, Biden told reporters in his Scranton moments after visiting the Granite Memorial. They never recovered his body, but the government went back, and when I went down there, and they checked and found some parts of the plane and the like, said Biden. Next, first law protecting consumers' brainwaves is signed in Colorado. Colorado Governor Jared Polis on Wednesday signed into law the first measure passed in the U.S. that aims to protect the data found in a person's brainwaves. Sponsors of the bill said it was necessary as quick advances in neurotechnology make scanning, analyzing, and selling mental data increasingly more possible and profitable. State Representative Kathy Kipp, a sponsor of the legislation, said in a statement that while advancement in the neurotechnology field holds great promise for improving the lives of many people, we must, she said, provide a clear framework to protect Coloradans' personal data from being used without their consent, while still allowing these new technologies to develop. State Senator Kevin Priola, another of the bill's sponsors, said that neurotechnology is no longer confined to medical or research settings, and that when it comes to consumer products, the industry can currently operate without regulation, data protection standards, or equivalent ethical constraints. The Neuro Rights Foundation, a nonprofit promoting the ethical development of neurotechnology, said Colorado's bill, which it supported, was the first of its kind in the U.S. And finally, Google lays off employees, shifts some roles abroad. Alphabet-owned Google is laying off an unspecified number of employees, a company spokesperson said on Wednesday, making the latest cuts at the technology giant as it cracks down on costs. The Google spokesperson said the layoffs are not company-wide and that affected employees will be able to apply for internal roles, but did not specify the number of employees impacted nor the teams involved. A small percentage of the impacted roles will be moved to hubs the company is investing in, including India, Chicago, Atlanta, and Dublin. The layoffs follow a slew of job cuts across Google and the tech and media industry this year, adding to fears that layoffs may continue as companies grapple with economic uncertainty. And that brings us to the end of this ship. For the last 90 minutes, your readers have been Lisa Horsch and me, Twyla Glenn. It has been our pleasure to read for you. Now we'll take a short break to allow our next readers to get into place.
Your new readers are Teresa Whitaker and Dorothy Hockenberg. We'll continue with articles from the Des Moines Register and USA Today. Here's Dorothy with our next article.
This editorial is by Lucas Grundmeier on behalf of the Register Editorial Board. And it is titled, Iowa Civil Rights Commission Should Keep Its Power. The Iowa Civil Rights Commission is charged with investigating and mediating complaints about unfair treatment and recommending policy changes to enhance fairness. For almost 60 years, commissioners appointed by the governor have had authority to advocate for equitable policies and to scrutinize discrimination in housing, employment, and other areas. Language in Governor Kim Reynolds' bill to eliminate or overhaul many of the state's appointed boards and commissions would drastically change that process in favor of giving a single governor-appointed agency director most of that authority. Members of the current commission to oppose the move and the Iowa-Nebraska chapter of the NAACP has been lobbying lawmakers to resist this section of Senate File 2385, which Iowa House approved Tuesday and return to the Senate so it can consider amendments unrelated to the commission. Republicans have not been shy about their legislative efforts to limit opportunities for people in the executive branch to chart any course that diverges from the governor's views. They've framed this as vesting accountability in the governor, who is directly elected by Iowans, unlike appointed agency directors, board members, and hired employees. The wisdom of using this principle to reshape state government is debatable, but its application to the Civil Rights Commission is wrong. The commission's existence, its missions, and its independence have nothing to do with the ease of which Iowa governors execute their agendas. That is, unless their agendas include allowing landlords and employers to treat Iowans unfairly or suppressing discussion of unique barriers that individuals or groups confront. The setup of the current boards benefits us all. A commission last summer comprehensively reviewed hundreds of boards and made hundreds of overarching and individual recommendations. Here is the entirety of its final report's comments on the Civil Rights Commission. Quote, "The commission's membership should be reduced from 7 to 5 members. The commission's authority should also be thoroughly reviewed and clarified," end quote. Well, the clarity appears to be upending the way the body has operated for decades. Reynolds' proposal, introduced in February, includes language moving authority to the director of the Office of Civil Rights, with the commission essentially becoming an advisory group whose advice the director could accept or ignore. The provisions stuck through the Iowa Senate's passage of the bill. The Iowa House on Tuesday modified its own less aggressive Boards and Commission bill to incorporate the language scuttling civil rights review. The House approved Senate File 2385 in a 54-42 vote, with 8 Republicans joining all Democrats present in opposition. It's a benefit, not a bug, that the Civil Rights Commission's 7 members are drawn from around the state and that they're volunteers, not depending on the governor's good graces for their livelihood. Vesting authority in an individual civil rights director forfeits advantages of shared decision-making authority among people with varying perspectives and the latitude to stand up to the governor without jeopardizing their job. The argument is not made from the perspective of the Register editorial board seeking to preserve the powers of an aggressive, progressive body. At one meeting this year, according to online documents, commissioners voted against lobbying to preserve gender identity protections in civil rights law. Rather, our aim is to preserve the opportunity for everyday Iowans from all corners of the state with different perspectives and lived experiences to have a direct role in protecting bedrock freedoms, Iowa's civil rights. Proponents seem to dislike the prospect of people occasionally sharing views publicly that don't align with the governor's or of some modest policy making that's outside the governor's direct control. It's not at all clear that giving the governor that direct control poses any less of a concern. Narrow focuses of some boards to be eliminated had purpose, too. Some other board reorganizations and eliminations are cause for concern, too. But Democratic senators who questioned some of them on the floor were told that responsibilities would still be attended to by various departments. That may be, but it's hard to imagine the focused advocacy of narrowly drawn boards and commissions being truly replaced. For instance, lawmakers are poised to eliminate commissions dedicated to African Americans, Asian and Pacific Islanders, persons with disabilities, Latino affairs, Native American affairs, and the status of women, to be subsumed by a single human rights board. No matter the skill or dedication of members of that board, They won't be able to identify unique problems and push for solutions as easily as dedicated boards. The state could have made progress on modernizing its boards and commissions without taking away the influence of its Civil Rights Commission. It will be a shame if independent review shrivels, and with it, one fears the right of Iowans, again by Lucas Grandmeier on behalf of the Register Editorial Board.
Now, the Another View column by guest columnist Robert Leonard. What is merit after gender balance law repeal? If you read a guest essay in the Des Moines Register on April 4th, you might think that Charles Hurley, with The Family Leader, is a civil rights hero. Not so fast. Hurley is no such hero. In fact, the efforts of Hurley and The Family Leader have been steadfast in their desire to deny LGBTQ+ Iowans of their civil rights, including the right to marry, and the recently passed religious freedom law that opponents believe is a license to discriminate against the LGBTQ+ community and more. The group's opposition to safe legal abortion for women is also seen as a civil rights issue by many. The essay is titled, Iowa Gender Balance Laws Repeal Ends Unconstitutional Discrimination in Public Service. The hagiography was written by Jeffrey Jennings and Kylene Lindgren with the law firm that represented Hurley when he sued the state because he wasn't appointed to the Judicial Nominating Committee because of his gender. Of course, he did what many of the privileged class do when they don't get what they want. They sue. Iowa's gender balance law was put into effect in the 1980s to increase the number of women on state commissions and boards and was made effective for local governments in 2009. There were no penalties for noncompliance, but it worked. Women make up about 48% of the representatives on state boards and commissions. The authors make the case that merit should be the main consideration in making appointments, as if merit is something that can be objectively measured rather than the abstract social construct it is. To me, Hurley seems well qualified for the Judicial Nominating Committee position he wanted, but the authors suggest that part of his qualifications include that he is a devoted father and grandfather who spent the past 40 years as an attorney, public representative, and active church member. What about a brilliant young rock star woman attorney who is a single mom who is Hindu? Is she less qualified? I think not. Sorry to say, but as one, being a grandfather is a pretty weak qualification to be on a board or commission. Besides, as a retired reporter, I've covered city council meetings and board of supervisors meetings in 7 counties for nearly 20 years, and I've been in on the deliberations where a black man or a white woman has been the most qualified applicant for the job, yet they aren't hired because they aren't right for the community. A pastor friend tells me the same happens across the state in churches. Without objective measures, merit is a social construct that often keeps the privileged and those like them in power. And there's oodles of hypocrisy here. Look at the board of directors of The Family Leader, where their 8-member board has only one woman. Hurley and the rest of the leadership might try to convince us that all those old white guys and one woman gained their positions on the board solely on merit, but I doubt we would believe them. That again was from Robert Leonard, who writes at Deep Midwest, Politics and Culture, and has bylines in the Des Moines Register, the Iowa Capital Dispatch, the New York Times, Time, USA Today, and many more publications.
Okay, turning now letters to the editor. Our first one is from John Beisner in Ames. Will Iowa's senators stop farmers from getting loans forgiven? Is forgiving loans for farmers and or for students socialism? As President Joe Biden announced plans to cancel some students' loans after 10 years of payments as part of his SAVE plan, Senator Joni Ernst is determined to block it. It's a news release, she called it, student loan socialism. In 2007, Republican President George W. Bush signed the Public Service Loan Forgiveness Act, allowing for those working in public service jobs who have paid toward their student loans for 10 years to have some or all of their loans forgiven. Senators Ernst and Chuck Grassley, along with Representative Randy Feenstra, have been lobbying for farming to be recognized as a public service job and therefore qualifying for loan forgiveness. All three of these legislators have advocated for passage of the Young Farmers Success Act, which would make farmers eligible for the Public Service Loan Forgiveness Program. So, Senator Ernst, if forgiving student loans is socialism, would forgiving loans to farmers be socialism? And if so, would you oppose that legislation? Somehow, Senator, I think you would be in favor of forgiving the loans for farmers while opposing them for other students. Is that a definition of hypocrisy? That from John Beisner of Ames. This next one is from Sean Gannon of Des Moines. Iowa Republicans are hypocrites on food labeling. In May 2023, the U.S. Supreme Court ruled against Iowa pork producers who had sued California over a law banning the sale of meat statewide if cages didn't meet the state's new anti-animal cruelty requirements. The entire Iowa GOP railed against the ruling. As Agriculture Secretary Mike Naig summarized, it would allow one state, quote, to dictate the laws and regulations for consumers and businesses to the rest of America, end quote, resulting in a, quote, state-by-state patchwork of ever-changing and costly requirements that will increase the costs of production and drive higher costs for food and other consumer products, end quote. Now, the Iowa GOP is taking the exact same action Republicans lambasted a year ago, demanding the specific packaging language for any non-meat product, lest it be banned from sale in Iowa. Republicans' positions are so fluid, one never knows what they believe. Oh, and they also threw in a ban on egg substitutes for recipients of SNAP assistance. Taking swipe at the poor is the one issue on which they can always be trusted. That from Sean Gannon in Des Moines. This next and last letter is from David R. Whitke of Des Moines. I'll say it, $50,000 could go to something other than prom. Some stodgy old codger is bound to ask, so it may as well be me. Why does a high school class need a $50,000 gift from JCPenney to stage their senior prom? My high school's prom was put on by the junior class to honor the seniors. The juniors pitched in for several days after classes to decorate the school gym quite elaborately. Materials and other expenses were paid from the junior class treasury, earned by running the coat check room at basketball games. A student combo, supplemented by a student disc jockey, provided the dance music. Before the dance, some of us took our dates to dinner at a restaurant one step up from the A&W. Some of us settled for the refreshments the juniors provided at the gym. Several years later, the parents, concerned about after-prom safety, inaugurated a post-prom dance till dawn gathering at a local church hall. We all had a swell time and could feel proud of what we'd accomplished. I can't help but think that everyone would have been better off if that $50,000 had been used to offset Governor Kim Reynolds' rejection of millions in federal money intended to feed Iowa's hungriest kids. Again, that by David R. Whitke of Des Moines.
Okay, now we're going to turn to the sports section, and I'm going to start with what's on TV this evening or today. We have in the National Hockey League at 6 p.m. this evening on ESPN, Seattle is at Minnesota. Following that, at 8:30 p.m., we have Edmonton at Colorado. In Major League Baseball today at 12:10, we have Texas at Detroit on the MLBN. And following that, it says that it's at the same time on the same network, we have LA Angels at Tampa Bay. Okay, at 6:40 p.m. this evening on ESPN Plus, we have Miami at Chicago. And at 8:45 p.m., we have Arizona at San Francisco on FS1. Okay, we'll turn to the front page. We have an article on college men's basketball. Drake lands three commits from Northwest Missouri State. This is by Alyssa Hurdle. Drake men's basketball secured its first commitments since Ben McCollum's hiring as head coach. Former Northwest Missouri State players Bennett Sturts, Isaiah Jackson, and Daniel Abreu will follow their former coach to Des Moines. All three announced their decisions on social media on Tuesday. Sturts, a 6'4" guard, was named the MIAA Freshman of the Year in his first season at Northwest Missouri State and earned second-team honors for the 2023-24 season. In his sophomore year, Sturts started all 34 games and ranked second on the team in scoring and assists. He averaged 15.2 points and 3.5 assists per game and led the Bearcats with 47 steals. Sturts added 3.5 rebounds per game. He shot 51% from the floor. The Missouri native was the first player to join Drake's roster since Darian DeVries left for West Virginia and McCollum took over as head coach. He was joined later in the day by Bearcats teammates Jackson and Abreu. Abreu, a 6'6" forward, tallied 10.6 points and 3.1 rebounds per game in the 2023-24 season. He shot 54.6% from the field and 35.9% from three-point range. He was named the MIAA tournament's most outstanding player after averaging 17.3 points per game and helping the Bearcats to another title. Jackson, a 6'2" guard, averaged 7 points, 5.4 rebounds, and 4.6 assists in the 2023-24 campaign, while shooting 43.4% from the field. He was named to the conference's all-defensive team and led the Bearcats with 146 assists. And then we have, also in college men's basketball, UNI's Bourne enters the transfer portal by Gus Martin. Northern Iowa men's basketball's Bowen Bourne will enter the transfer portal, the guard announced Tuesday on Instagram. Coming to UNI was one of the easiest decisions I've ever made, and deciding to leave was one of the hardest, Bourne wrote. I love UNI, and to my core, and have loved everything about this program, including my coaches, teammates, support, staff, and managers. Coach Ben Jacobson is one of the most important people in my life and will always be someone I look to for guidance. I could not be more thankful for our time together. But as I graduate from UNI in May, I believe it's time for a change in my life. It's incredibly hard to say goodbye to a program I've loved and given my all to these past 4 years, so it is with mixed emotions that I will be playing my last year of college basketball elsewhere. I'm proud to be a Panther and receive my degree from UNI. I will cherish my years in Cedar Falls forever. Thank you to everyone for making this part of my journey so special. The Norwalk native played all 4 years of his college career with the Panthers, starting 89 of his 118 played games. Bourne averaged 12.6 points, 2.2 assists, and 2.1 rebounds per game on 39.8, 34.5, and 85.4 shooting splits. And most notably, was named Missouri Valley Conference Freshman of the Year in 2020-21, MVC Sixth Man of the Year in 2021-22, and Second Team All-MVC in 2022-23. He finished his UNI career among the top 10 scorers in program history, 1,486 points, and ranks fourth in three-pointers made, 209. Bourne's first season came as a junior in 2022-23, in which he averaged career highs in both points, 17.9, and assists, 2.7 per game, before dropping to 13.3 and 1.8 respectively as a senior. Bourne was a two-star recruit coming out of Norwalk High School, according to 247 Sports, following a career that saw him be named Iowa's Mr. Basketball, Iowa Gatorade Player of the Year, First Team All-State, and All-Tournament Team Captain at the state tournament. As a senior in high school, Bourne averaged 36.4 points per game, shot 54.4% from the field, and 40.6% from deep. He ranks sixth all-time in the state of Iowa in scoring, 2,494 points.
We now turn to Dear Abby, who writes, "Women believes her mom is playing favorites. Dear Abby, I am on a limited income. My younger sister, Tara, is a medical professional with disposable income she spends on frivolous things. I have one son, age 13. She has three children, ages 14, 10, and 3. Tara and I live a few miles apart. Our mother lives 60 miles away. My mother keeps my sister's kids every other week. She rarely keeps my son. I must bring my son to her. She drives all the way to Tara's house to pick up her kids and take them home. I have borrowed a rather decent sum of money from my mother. She regularly asks me about paying it back. She spends a lot of extra money on food for Tara's kids because of their special dietary needs. Between that and all the driving back and forth, my mother has spent nearly twice as much catering to my sister as what I have borrowed in the same amount of time. I feel this is very one-sided and that, for some reason, my mother cares more about Tara than about me. I also feel like my son is neglected by my mother. Am I wrong for feeling like this? Should I say something or just leave it alone?" That is from Lopsided in Georgia. Abby responds, "Dear Lopsided, it appears you are jealous of your sister for many reasons. Your mother has the right to spend her time and money on whatever she pleases, as does your sister. I don't know why your mother favors Tara's children. Perhaps it's time to ask her why. As to her request you repay the money she has loaned you, I suggest you work out a repayment plan starting now, in the hope that it will improve your relationship with her. But if that doesn't happen, arrange for someone else to watch your son." This next letter is, "Dear Abby, when I met my husband, I felt valued. But ever since I got pregnant, he no longer considers my feelings or treats me as a priority. The reason I married him was because he seemed loyal and dedicated to his family, and I thought he would be that way with us. However, during the last few months of my pregnancy, I have felt ignored. He is not really excited about the baby, and we haven't bonded while I am pregnant. I feel like I'm the last item on his list. I am slowly detaching from him. Even if things change when the baby is here, I don't think I'll respect him or have those love feelings anymore. I now see him in a different light that I find unattractive. Please help. At a crossroads in Maine." Abby replies, "Dear Crossroads, before this goes any further, recognize that you have steered yourself to a fork in the road. The path you should take is the one that leads to your OBGYN's office. Your doctor should be told what is happening in your head and in your marriage because you could be experiencing symptoms of prepartum depression. Do not put this off. Your baby is going to need a father, and the further you distance yourself from your husband, the less likely it will be that they have one."
That brings us to the end of the Des Moines Register for today. I'm Teresa Whitaker, and my partner at the microphone has been Dorothy Hockenberg. Earlier, you heard from Lisa Horsch and Twyla Glenn. You can listen to IRA's programs on any computer or smart device at any time at iowaradioreading.org. Support for today's readings comes from the Des Moines Register, Iowa Public Radio, Iowa PBS, and bensoundmusic.com. Thank you for listening to IRIS, Iowa's first and only reading service.